Right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the latest in our series of fortnightly Investec economic webinars. I'm Philip Shaw. I'm the chief economist for Investec here in London. I'm really happy to say that for the first time in 5 months, I'm speaking to you from our UK HQ at Gresham Street. Great to be back, and hopefully it's a bit of a lead indicator on some return to normality in due course. We've got a very interesting session in store for you today again. Much is happening on the economic and the coronavirus front and currencies, and I plan to give you an update on some of those thoughts. And I'm pleased to be joined by another of our Investec professionals that I've worked with for some time. That's Oisin Rhys. He'll speak to us on how privately owned companies are faring in these unusual times. Oisin joined Investec from ING, I think it was, to head our wholesale asset finance division in February 2013. In May last year, Oisin joined our private companies coverage team as a coverage banker who is dedicated to building partnerships with well-run privately owned clients. Morning, Oisin.
Good morning, Phil. Good morning, everybody.
Before I start, I'll just go through some of the usual housekeeping points. The first one is that all attendees will be automatically on mute. We've got a Q&A section at the end, and we would certainly encourage you to ask a question to us. And to submit a question, please use the Q&A feature on the right-hand sides of your screens. Type in a question and select all ask all panelists to submit it. If you've got any audio issues in the session, please type that into the Q&A section and our audiovisual team will contact you. We are recording this session, and I have to say that our comments don't constitute investment advice. Okay, let's just start by looking at the top-down situation with the coronavirus from a global perspective. And the number of reported cases now worldwide stands just shy of 17 million. Fatalities just over 650,000. Of course, these are reported numbers, so in a number of areas, you have to take the figures with a pinch of salt, of course. In terms of daily infection rates and daily fatality rates, they are still rising, unfortunately, in absolute terms. In terms of the number of cases, it's about 250,000 a day, deaths running at 5,500. There seems to be some flattening out, in at least in percentage terms, but that's a pretty low bar for assessing what the situation is. In terms of the countries most affected, the USA still has the highest number of cases. The number there is reported at just under 4.5 million. And then in terms of the other countries, it's Brazil, India, Russia, South Africa, Peru, and Mexico. And of course, what that is telling us is that there is a big problem in emerging markets. But even in developed markets, we've got cases in Europe, actually including the UK, rising now on a daily basis. The US infections may be beginning to flatten. It's a bit early to say. But as I said, these are reported cases and deaths, and you do have to treat the numbers with a bit of care. If we turn on the domestic situation, clearly the coronavirus numbers have come down from their peak in April. The lockdown has brought the infection under control. Here, if you look at average daily reported cases, we're running at about 675, deaths at around 65, and that actually compares with a peak of 5,000 per day in terms of cases and 1,000 deaths. The trend now, daily infections are probably running at about 100 a day higher than a month ago. If you remember the press briefings from March onwards, you'll remember all about the R number, the average transmission rate. The estimate for the UK officially is still between 0.7 to 0.9. In England, that seems to have pushed its way up 0.8 to 1.0. London is also 0.8 to 1.0. And a lot of people still see the R or RT number as the holy grail, but that there are a number of reasons why we shouldn't place too much reliance on R. And one is that R fails to account for the dispersion of transmission rates across the population, and it ignores any clustering, which in effect can be easier to deal with in many cases. And there was a research paper by Imperial College not long ago that excluded such clustering in places such as care homes and hospitals, and their estimate of R in May was 0.57. Now, this is where test and trace really comes into its own. And when I mention this, people either start laughing or they start groaning. But if you've got an effective system, it does enable you to lock down locally without shutting the whole economy down. Our guess is that the at-large transmission is pretty low in the UK. But of course, we're reopening the economy, including the leisure centre, the sector, and possibly some workplaces as well. And that's something which does need monitoring. On the economic side, quick reminder of the data. We know that the March figures were pretty awful. April's were even worse. And what we've seen since is an improvement in May and June and July further still, we think. And about a fortnight ago, we got GDP numbers for the UK for the month of May. That showed an increase of 1.8% up on the month. That followed, however, I think it was a 6.9% fall in March and a 20.3% decline on the month in April. And the May increase against that background was widely considered to be disappointing. But one has to consider that between April and May, we only saw a modest lifting of restrictions. The most significant, arguably, were an opening of DIY shops and garden centres. What we've seen subsequently is a much more significant relaxation of the restrictions. So, in particular, in mid-June, we saw a reopening of non-essential retailing, and that will help not just the June figures, but July as well. And in terms of the other anecdotal indicators which we look at, perhaps some of you that have read our latest global overview, which we published last week, may have seen this. Transport numbers and electricity demand are still strengthening. Subsequent to that, we saw a massive surge in retail sales in June. A key survey we look at, the PMI, the composite number, the overall number in July reached a 5-year high. So the recovery, we think, is gaining momentum as those COVID restrictions are being eased. Now, we've said this before, but we are looking at a sharp rebound from the trough. It is not a U-shaped recovery. It's a V. But we continue to think that it's a restricted V, that the recovery, perhaps in September, will begin to peter out a bit. What we're seeing is still a degree of household caution in many areas. Social distancing may restrict the recovery as well, and a fading of what I'd like to call the fiscal sugar rush. And the biggest element here is the furlough scheme, the Coronavirus Job Retention Scheme, which ends in October, and you've got nearly 9.5 million people on that. It's going to be a testing time for the economy, as a number of people unfortunately come off the furlough scheme and become unemployed. Now, in terms of forecast numbers, are they useful? We think they hide a multitude of sins, but just to give you an idea of scale, GDP, we think in Q2, we haven't got the official quarterly number yet, we expect to fall by 20.5%. We think that Q3 will also see a 25% rise in GDP. As I think I've mentioned before, that doesn't actually reverse the fall because your rebound is coming from a lower base. And we do think that growth will slow down towards the end of the year and through 2021 still. And the economy is unlikely to regain its pandemic size until late 2022, possibly 2023. In terms of the policy outlook, next week on Thursday, we've got a Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee meeting and also a monetary policy review. We haven't changed our view on interest rates. We think that the bank rate will remain at 0.1% for some time. At the moment, there's a widespread internal review at the Bank of England over whether there should be or could be some benefits to lowering the bank rate below zero. And our own house view is that baseline case is that we will not get negative rates, and certainly nothing forthcoming over the near term. Although we have to say that money markets are pricing in a greater than 50% chance of a further 25 basis point cut in the bank rate or a quarter of a percentage point cut in the first half of next year. So we don't think we can dismiss that idea completely. It's more likely, we think, in due course that the MPC votes for more QE, but again, not next week. We think next week will be a bit of a holding operation. If anything, we think that they will slow down the pace of quantitative easing gilt buying. They will keep the total asset purchase target at $745 billion, perhaps slow down gilt buying from $6 billion a week to $4 billion a week. And that will keep the programme on track until the end of the year and give the committee couple of months to assess whether more QE is needed to take us through into 2021. Fiscal policy is pretty interesting at the moment. If you look at the Office for Budget Responsibility's new central scenario, it's looking at a deficit of $322 billion this financial year, more when you take into account the summer statement measures from the Chancellor. The temporary measures of support, e.g. the furlough scheme, means that that takes the pressure off the deficit next year, but the fiscal metrics will still look worrying. But no matter what Rishi Sunak says or other members of the government, the priority from fiscal policy will be to keep the economy going. Yes, he's going to talk tough about reducing debt as a proportion of GDP, but a lot of that is to try and convince the fund management community and the ratings agencies that the UK is aware of the fiscal situation and it is a credible government. At some stage, though, perhaps even this autumn, you know, some measures may be taken to convince the markets he's serious. You know, we've perhaps about a digital sales tax in the UK. We may see an increase in corporation tax, I guess, deferred. And one thing which the government is doing is that there's a capital gains tax review as well. The government is saying, no, this is just a operation, but it could be one way of raising revenue in the future. Don't forget, Alistair Darling raised CGT in 2008, and so did George Osborne 2 years later, although I think Osborne subsequently lowered it again. I'll just finish off for a minute or two talking about sterling, and the pound is currently really strong against the dollar. It's currently testing the 130 level. It's also accurate to say that the dollar has been soft against most other currencies. The pound has, over the last 2 to 3 sessions, seen, you know, some buoyancy in its own right. So let's just look at quickly what's going on. On the dollar side, there are concerns that the momentum of the US economy is fading, that the new fiscal stimulus package has yet to be agreed. There are worries that the pandemic isn't being dealt with properly, and some talk over recent days that the US dollar could actually lose its reserve currency status. Now, from the sterling perspective, the main influence is Brexit, or more accurately, the trade talks between the UK and the EU. The latest so-called intensive rounds have resulted in no agreement between the parties. Michel Barnier, the chief EU negotiator, claimed last week that a trade agreement at this point is unlikely. But some observers have been noting there are some points of convergence. For example, we suspect you could see a deal. Now, Britain is quite free to diverge from EU rules. But if it doesn't diverge, it gets tariff-free trade and trade with minimal checks at the border. And, you know, it's that sort of packaging which could give the UK government some political cover and reduce the risks of friction trade. We can see a compromise on fishing. That shouldn't be too much of an issue. And that's why, if you take things from a UK-centric perspective, that the pound's got more support recently. We do think that we're going to get the talks going all the way to October. And if we don't get signs of an agreement between then and now, then that support from sterling will disappear. If we get a fiscal package agreed in the States, then that will support the US dollar. And it's actually quite easy to see sterling moving down to around 120 over the next 2 to 3 months if those dynamics happen as we expect. So that's where I'd like to leave things. I'll hand you over to Osh, who's going to talk about private companies.
Many thanks, Phil, and welcome everybody again. And thanks for joining us on this fine summer's day. Privately owned companies are an incredibly important part of our economy, with the latest government statistics showing that there are over 4 million such companies, and who collectively perhaps make them a significant employer. Being a relationship banker within a team that's dedicated to building partnerships with privately owned companies and having the experience to offer a full range of financial solutions along each step of a client's journey has been hugely exciting over the last 5 months. We're often the client's first call and have been inundated with both existing and new clients looking to expand or develop relationships with us, as they perhaps look to spread the risk of being overly dependent on existing banking relationships, or simply recognize that we have the ability to offer solutions that perhaps some of the existing funders can't. Today is, of course, about giving you an insight into what some of our private company clients are seeing and doing. I'll start by stating the obvious. None of our clients have previously witnessed an event that's caused a nearly instantaneous economic recession triggered by COVID-19, and that's wreaked havoc on businesses large and small. On the basis of sweeping proclamations like the end of the commuting, the demise of retail, and the collapse of globalization, it would have been easy to assume that everything would have changed, but that certainly hasn't been the case. In our experience, the reality of how companies are dealing with the crisis and preparing for the recovery tells a very different story, one of pivoting to business models conducive to both short-term survival and long-term resilience and growth. Survival immediately became the priority for most clients as they focused on cash and liquidity. Efforts were, of course, aided by Chancellor Sunak's decisive handling of the crisis as he rolled out business rate holidays, the coronavirus job retention scheme, and of course, the government-backed loan schemes. Indeed, such schemes have been pivotal in defining company behaviours over the last few months and have granted some companies not only the breathing space to survive, but also, in a number of cases, time to perhaps take a closer look at what's going on between the top and the bottom lines. The sudden switching off of income streams while still having suppliers, staff, and general overheads to pay has, of course, forced this change. Some clients have furloughed staff, and in doing so have realized that their businesses can survive, and in some cases even thrive, with fewer employees. This trimming of the fat will inevitably, and rather sadly, result in an increased number of redundancies, I suspect, before the end of the job retention scheme in October. Other clients have identified new risks in the supply chains, with some, for example, choosing to protect these supply chains by taking on additional debt facilities to offer perhaps improved payment terms to their suppliers. We've even seen some cash-rich clients take on debt facilities to give themselves adequate liquidity should recovery take longer than anticipated. Perhaps the decisions in doing so has been somewhat easier by the government-backed CBIL schemes offering no interest payments for the first year of such schemes. Nevertheless, and with the exception of a few harder hit sectors, we're undoubtedly seeing a good level of confidence returning on an accelerated basis. A number of our clients are long established and by association often have the experience to trade positively and even grow during a recession. Others are less well established, yet have been trading equally well during the crisis and are genuinely excited by what the immediate and long-term horizon looks like for them. So what makes private companies unique, and what other behaviours are we seeing amongst our privately owned client base? The answer, of course, is different by sector and by individual company, although perhaps each of our private company clients shares some common characteristics. They're typically entrepreneurial, quite restless spirits, and are always hardworking and incredibly motivated. They more often than not employ workers with some out-of-the-box ideas, and above all, they're decisive and risk tolerant. In our experience, a number are also quite nimble and have the conviction to make on-the-spot decisions, which perhaps gives them a slight edge over their larger competitors. Above all, most entrepreneurs that we talk to certainly want to ensure that they don't let this crisis go to waste. To ensure that they're well positioned to continue on their growth journey, the attention of these clients has more recently shifted towards looking at their debt and equity structures. Indeed, some have immediate opportunities to acquire, whilst others are facing much higher demand for their products. Having a partner like Investec that, perhaps unusually for a bank, can look at both debt and equity structures has proven to be an invaluable part of the conversations with these clients. For example, our colleagues in our private companies fundraising team and separately on our principal investments teams have both been exceptionally busy securing new mandates for equity rises. Colleagues on our growth and leverage finance team have been similarly busy increasing some existing debt facilities and in setting up new facilities for clients that give them adequate headroom to facilitate continued growth. As I alluded to earlier, we're also offering an increased number of CBIL and CLBIL facilities. A good example, perhaps recently, where our working capital team wrote a CBILS-backed term loan to give a fast-growing client the equity that they need to invest alongside an increased working capital facility that we're providing. And perhaps that's a good example of something that wouldn't have been readily available without that CBIL support. And of course, our ability to offer both gave the client an easy one-stop shop solution. Some of our other divisions are equally busy, although we perhaps understandably have seen some privately owned companies' decisions to either sell or indeed to buy being postponed, albeit none have been cancelled. On the flip side, the current demand for our M&A advisory services from our privately owned clients is very high, as we're involved in a number of increasing conversations with clients about potential sale of their business, as perhaps the shareholders turn their attention towards fulfilling other personal goals. Indeed, a lot of these shareholders and entrepreneurs have their entire wealth tied up in these companies. Unlocking this wealth and maximizing value certainly seems to have moved closer to the front of mind during the pandemic. The company sales process itself and other similar event-driven opportunities gives us a very good opportunity to introduce our clients to our wealth managers, whom collectively manage approximately about 37 billion of assets under management. In my role, it's especially pleasing not only to be able to help our clients in their wealth creation journey, but for myself and for Investec to play a pivotal role in their wealth conversion and wealth management journey thereafter. Something that's perhaps made easier by a number of these clients using our private banking facilities somewhere along the journey. Elsewhere, clients continue to carefully manage their flow banking and risk management needs. Against a backdrop of record low bank base, we've seen an inflow of client deposits where they're offering some compelling deposit rates. After an initial lull caused by the almost overnight falling imports and exports, our FX dealers are now seeing trading return to more normal levels as manufacturing production improves and other events such as the rise in debt and political and social uncertainty and instability in the US, looming Brexit, breakdown in the US and China talks continue to cause currency fluctuations. Otherwise, relatively low oil and energy prices in general has resulted in a number of clients, particularly those with large diesel buying requirements, hedging against any future upward movements. Only time will tell what else lies ahead, but right now the mood appears to be one of cautious optimism and perhaps coupled with needle-sharp risk management. We've certainly come a long way from the suppressed days of April and May and appear to be carefully heading towards recovery. Phil, as you mentioned in your economic update just now, there's quite a lot of uncertainty out there, which in itself will create opportunities for some and challenges for others. On that note, I'll leave it there. If I could hand back to you for some final remarks and perhaps to open the floor up to some questions.
That's fabulous. Thanks very much, Osh. Clearly, you've been kept very busy over the past few months. We do have a question, actually, and that is that you're clearly seeing a variety of transactions. That's pretty clear. Are you seeing any common themes emerge from your clients at all?
Yes, there are a few, actually, Phil. I alluded to earlier clients taking a more forensic approach and looking perhaps a little bit deeper under the bonnet. The example of clients perhaps cleverly or innovatively using CLBILS facilities or CBILS facilities to protect their supply chain. That's something that a lot of clients that we talk to are perhaps concerned about. In a similar vein, where we deal with wholesale distributors, there might be a little bit more stockpiling going on. That perhaps was already happening with Brexit looming, but certainly there's a little bit of a sharper focus in that regard. And I'd also add that it's probably we're experiencing deeper engagement at an earlier stage with clients. The example I gave of clients looking at perhaps what an exit might look like and planning for that and working out the best journey for that and perhaps how we can help them with that journey is something that's closer to front of mind for clients and perhaps a bit of a common theme. As I said, it's been an interesting 5 months.
Okay, thank you very much. I would encourage participants to put their questions in. We do have one. I think this is probably for me. And it is, do you think Donald Trump will lose the election in November? And what do you think the implications are if he does? Our house view is that Trump will probably lose the election. If you look at the polls at the moment, his net approval rating is something like minus 15%. He's trailing Joe Biden, his challenger, by a considerable margin, including the swing states, which he needs to hold on to win again. So things can change, but we think he will lose. Biden is talking about higher tax increases, higher corporation tax, up 5 percentage points, for example. But it's also important to remember that it's not just the presidential elections that are happening. You've got the whole of the House of Representatives and 35 Senate seats out of the 100 as well. And at the moment, the polls are saying that the Democrats will hold on to the House. With the Senate, it could be quite a close run thing. And although the Republicans are defending, I think it's 23 out of the 35, they're sort of playing defense, if you like, there. They're mainly in sort of very solid Republican seats, and the Democrats will probably lose states such as Alabama, which they hold at the moment. And, you know, it's at the moment it's 53-47 to the Republicans. So we think it's close. Unless the Democrats get a clean sweep, it's going to be much more difficult for Biden to raise taxes because the Republicans will simply hold this up in the Senate. So the Senate could be the main battleground. But as I said earlier, you know, the polls can change and the situation generally can change pretty quickly. So in the absence of any further questions, just to say, you know, thank you very much to Wash for his fascinating presentation. Thank you to yourselves for participating. And we would ask you to dial in again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much and keep safe.